Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude. This is the Master of Ceremonies, Lady J, y'all. How's everybody doing? Are your spidey senses tingling yet? For episode 114 and 115, we are having an epic celebration for New York City's friendly neighborhood webhead. The one and the only, the amazing, not Lady J, but it is actually going to be the Peter Parker. May 30th will actually mark the release of issue 800 of The Amazing Spider-Man, which for many a comic book fan is one of the most influential titles to be swipping its way from spinner racks and local comic shops for the last 55 years. Damn, Stanley! So, to celebrate the web slinger's storied history, Eric Anthony got together with two Spidey aficionados, both returning for the first time, the sensational Sam Noir, and the curator of comic culture, Kev the Mev Boyd. These episodes are jam-packed with intense spider talk. All three gentlemen count down their top five Spidey stories, as well as debate over legendary artists, writers, and characters, and unavoidably get tangled in the webs of numerous Spidey tangents. So, here we go. Sit back and enjoy the ride, and hit up your local comic shop and pick up issue 800.
In honor of issue number 800 coming out this May of The Amazing Spider-Man. So with me tonight are the aficionados. First guest that's returning. Both of them are returning, but the first guest returning to the cave is the spectacular Sam Noir. Sam, how's it going?
Hello. How you doing? Feels like I was just on the show.
It's like you came back like you left your wallet here with us.
There you go. But we this is a continuation of sorts with our deviation into the Spider-Man.
Yeah, it inspired this episode. So when we talked about this episode, I said, who else could I get who would be able to add a lot of the knowledge of the Spider-Man mythos as much as Sam Noir could? And I thought of this guy here. Or perhaps more so. So this gentleman is the curator and coordinator of comic book culture in the Greater Toronto Area and the United States in a lot of ways, right? Yeah. And Canada.
Yeah. Multiple conventions.
It is Mr. Kevin Boyd. Kevin, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back. If there's one topic I could talk about for hours, it's Spider-Man.
So we got to make this a regular thing, guys. So we got to do different. Cover. Yes, exactly.
We have other lists eventually that we can. Movies alone, I bet we could fill an entire.
Oh, for sure. Well, yeah. I have a movies podcast.
That's right. Have you ever done Spider-Man?
I don't think we've gone back and reviewed all of the Spider-Man.
Okay, so that would, and I would also love to include animation and TV shows too. We briefly talked about my love of Japanese Spider-Man.
Okay.
Yeah, no, and when you mentioned that,
did you go watch Japanese Spider-Man?
I didn't watch it. I watched the opener of it, but then
Spider-Man.
And I went into the my omnibus of Spider-Verse, and I looked for the page that you were referencing. I'm like,
Leo Pardon.
Yeah, and I remember reading that and not understanding, like, why is there a Power Ranger in this? And I'm like, now it means so much more because Sam explained it to me. Okay, so getting into our top five list of Spider-Man stories, I mean, how many issues would you say of Spider-Man have been printed through all the different titles?
Thousands.
There's close to 2,000?
Thousands.
Probably more than that. I mean, you have 800 issues of Amazing right away.
Right.
And then you've got Spectacular, Marvel Team-Up, Web of
Spider-Man. Peter Parker. So those would likely come close to 1,000 as well if you added all those up. Mm-hmm. The crossovers, the graphic novels.
Yep. Yeah.
Miniseries.
Yeah.
Miniseries crossovers. So
we talked a little bit last time, Sam, about how you got into Spider-Man, why it was such an important character for you, why it resonated with you. I don't think I ever asked you, Kev.
So I started reading comics in the early 70s, and mostly I started reading my older brother's comics. He was 4 years older. So he had a good stack of books, and I was always fascinated with the Batman TV show and the Spider-Man cartoon show, the 60s one. So I think I just started gravitating towards Spider-Man comics almost right from the start. And we were blessed in that time because not only did we have Amazing Spider-Man coming out every month, we had Marvel Team-Up coming out every month. And then we also had Marvel Tales, which reprinted the early Spider-Mans. So I was getting that history at the same time as I was buying the latest issues. So
I added Spidey Super Stories was around that time as well.
Well, a little later. That was more like 75, 76. Same thing with Peter Parker's Spectacular Spider-Man. I remember my father bringing that home from a trip, and that was a big deal. But I was like 6 at the time, so... Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, it's all right.
I was going to say, what was it about the character particularly that resonated with you? Was it just because it was like a first discovery, or was there something about Peter Parker or Spider-Man that appealed?
I love the costume.
Mm-hmm.
I love the power set. I love the idea of being able to jump around. And Spider-Man was funny. Spider-Man was, he's this engaging, quipping character. Unfortunately, I carry a lot of his puns forward as I'm having conversations, but that's something I picked up from reading Spider-Man comics and all the years and loving the character. So,
what was your first Spider-Man comic, Cap?
My first Spider-Man comic was probably a reprint of Amazing 104.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that was, which they're in the Savage Land,
mm-hmm.
in that one. And then the first, when I got into collecting comics, my first back issue was Amazing Spider-Man 18.
Oh, wow.
The one where I found that for 50 cents. It was beaten up like crazy.
Dude.
At some kind of pawn shop show or something like that. That got me on the track of buying back issues of Amazing. Mm. Seeing how early I could get in the run, so...
I remember hearing on another show, I think it was Speech Bubble, you had said that you had every issue of Amazing Spider-Man up until which issue did you have?
I didn't get an AF-15. That was the only one I didn't get.
Right.
But I had a full run of Amazing. And I probably would have... I think I sold off my collection around issue 400 in that era, around that time period. So it would have been 400 issues or so.
What was your favorite find that you, during that time of hunting, which was the one that's like, this is...
Well, I mean, getting the Spider-Man 1 was the final book.
Okay.
And I still remember the copy. It was a great, CGC graded it as a 1.8. And I got Stan Lee to sign it.
Wow.
So, but it was an interesting copy because it had a history to it. The person who owned it had water damage in their apartment. And they had kept their older comics in a box under a couch, which is a strange place to store comics. But they were flat, and they were in good shape. But the Spider-Man one was on top, and water was sitting on top of it in the box. So he picked it up, and he brushed the water off, and flecks of color came out with it. So it almost looked like Spider-Man, the cover with FF and Spider-Man sticking to the glass wall. And so he had little dots all over him of white.
That is heartbreaking.
But the book was fantastic. It was in great shape. Just had that warbly feel to it. The spine was great. You could almost do qualified. You could say it was like a qualified 4 or a qualified 5.
Did you ever own an Amazing Fantasy 15?
I never did. And one funny story about me was when I was in grade school, they interviewed my class. It would have been like the grade 1 class. What would you like for Christmas? The one thing that you'd like for Christmas? And here I am, I would have been like 7 years old. I said I wanted Amazing Fantasy 15, first appearance of Spider-Man. And they quoted me, and it was in the Toronto Sun. It was a half page. I want a copy of Amazing Fantasy 15, first appearance of Spider-Man, Kevin Boyd, age 8.
Wow.
Or something like
that. Do you still have this clipping?
It's probably somewhere in a box.
I want to see this clipping. That's awesome.
But all the other kids are in like a pony or in like that go on a trip or something like that. And here I am, I want a back issue. So.
Did either of you guys ever write in to Amazing Spider-Man and get your letter published?
I was never a letterhead.
No, never
did.
Okay.
I had friends who wrote into other books and had their letters published, but not me.
I remember I bought some Amazing Spider-Man from Daryl at the Third Quadrant. And one of the books I bought from him, he flipped through it and showed that his letter had been printed.
Oh, wow.
I think it was the issue with Willow the Wisp.
Okay.
Oh,
Roger Stern. Yeah, if you read the back there, he wrote a letter. So it was pretty funny. Yeah.
I'll check that out when I get home.
Yeah. So how do you guys, which direction should we go? You want to start with Kevin?
Yeah,
let's go with Kevin. You got a nice extensive list there. Martin Slam Dunkin would be very proud.
I did my research. We should probably ask why there, we have two qualifiers, right?
Yes. Let's start off with that. So
the craven in the room.
That's right. So for those listening, we all know that Kraven's Last Hunt and Death of Gwen Stacy are supposed to be on every top five Spider-Man story list. We're excluding them because they're the obvious pick. So with two guys here who are experts, I wanted them to dig deep and really give me their favorites to share with us. So if you don't hear those ones, it's not because we don't know our Spider-Man.
And there's been a lot of talk about Kraven and the death of Gwen Stacy on other forums. And I bet we could talk about those two for an entire podcast as well. And I'm sure they're on my list. I'm sure they're on your list.
You have to put them on the list.
Kevin's list. So we've purposely decided. And our list is also our personal favorites. So
exactly.
I think that's important to rather than any sort of qualified poll or anything like that. We're just saying these are our personal favorites. These are the ones we love that we want to share in this conversation with other Spider fans at the table today.
All right, and so we've each picked our top five, and I guess the plan is that we'll just rotate through the list.
In descending order.
Okay.
All right, well, speaking of Spider-Man A-Team, my number five pick is Amazing Spider-Man 17 to 19. The titles of the issues are The Return of the Green Goblin, The End of Spider-Man, and Spidey Strikes Back. And so this, to me, is like the sort of the first example you see Spider-Man dramatically quitting being Spider-Man for some reason. So some event has made him look bad, and so he decides, you know what, I should just give this thing, I'll walk away from it. And really it starts with the Green Goblin, who appeared in number 14, his first appearance, but three issues, he was popular enough to come right back. And
we didn't know his identity back then.
It was a big mystery of who he was. He was around, but nobody knew his whole thing. He'd always be changing in the shadows and whatnot. So, at the high school, Liz Allen has decided to show her appreciation of Spider-Man by throwing a big event, the Spider-Man fan club. And his arch nemesis at the school, Flash Thompson, is head of the fan club and Spider-Man's biggest fan. So they do this event. She puts together this event and says, Spider-Man will be here. So the Green Goblin goes to fight him. The Human Torch goes to stand him up and show how he's a better superhero than Spider-Man is, and a better guy anyway, because all these beautiful teenage girls are falling over Spider-Man. The Torch has to get his thing in there. So all this is
the start of a rivalry between those two, right?
Like, yeah.
It
really started as far as back as Spider-Man 3, the Doc Ock issue. So
didn't they have the team up as well? They started the early issues of Marvel Team Up too, right?
Yeah, but Marvel Team Up was a decade later.
Oh, was it?
These stories, yeah.
Oh, you're right.
So but there were little bits of he would always insult him, Matchstick or whatever he called him. The problem is Peter's Aunt May is sick and needs something. I can't remember the reason why she's sick.
She's always sick. It's a trope.
Yeah.
So Peter has to leave the fight to rescue Aunt May because he overhears a phone call from his aunt looking for him. And so he leaves, and everybody says, well, look at that. Spider-Man just walked out of this huge fight and left these poor kids defenseless against the Green Goblin, even though the Human Torch was there and took care of them. Spider-Man, everybody paints Spider-Man as a coward. So the next issue, number 18, he's kind of on the run. He's got to do a few things, and Sandman is out on the street. He runs from Sandman, so everybody's assuming he's a coward. He's given up. So he throws away the costume. Aunt May gets better at the end of the issue. He puts on his costume and strikes back in the next issue and takes out the Sandman, takes out the Green Goblin, sort of gets his act together. Just one of those fun kind of Spider-Man's down, Spider-Man comes back and kicks ass kind of stories. Yeah.
And it's Lee and Ditko creating the formula, essentially.
Yeah.
Exactly.
These are a lot of firsts in there.
Yes. So, and I love Lee and Ditko, as you'll find out. So, and of course, the personal connection for me with Spider-Man 18 being the oldest back issue I bought. So.
Would I be jumping ahead to if I asked you prefer Ditko or do you prefer John Romita?
Hands down, Ditko. To me, Ditko is,
really?
The,
okay.
is the quintessential Spider-Man artist, as even Romita will tell you.
Mm-hmm.
He thought it was Ditko's strip. He was the fill-in artist. He was, and he ended up doing like three times the amount of work, but or four
yeah,
times.
Yeah.
But he still felt he was on somebody else's strip.
Mm. I was going to actually ask that once we were done the round. I was going to make both
oh,
of you decide,
okay,
Romita
sure,
or Ditko.
Okay.
No, no, that's good that you brought it up. You read my mind. That's good.
That was cute. Yeah. We'll jump back to that.
How about you, Sam? Romita or Ditko?
To be honest, Romita.
Yeah?
Mostly because I love both. I
yeah.
love both, but there's a certain, you know, in terms of iconic, he's had so many, and he also did the comic strip. When I first started reading it, and
yeah.
then I think sort of the high point was that the soap opera
yes.
and love triangle days, and as you'll see from my list, that oftentimes that sort of the relationships and stuff sort of trump what I look for. Although I love the Ditkos, I first read them in the little paperback books,
yep.
the pocket books,
yep.
and they were so, and the Fireside book too,
yep.
and they were so. Strange that and,
yep.
and Doctor Strange,
mm-hmm.
you could tell they were the same guy, and just the figures didn't there was just something, the way they moved and the sense of design and even almost the psychedelic
yeah, yeah.
aspect of it. Like if you had told me that Ditko was the most straight laced guy around, you wouldn't believe it. Just between
yeah.
all the inventiveness of his the villains he came up with, all the
yeah.
classic villains.
Yeah,
you essentially
have to tip your hat to him for that.
Yeah,
yeah.
and
yeah.
then all the craziness, the other dimensional vision of
yeah.
of you know, the nightmare realm and Dormammu's realm and all the rest that would just show up in Doctor Strange. Yeah, love to both, but I will lean over towards Romita, just as sort of in my mind what I
yeah.
I conjure when I think of the most iconic Spider-Man I can
yeah,
from my childhood.
I understand that, because I always think of that image from the 60s cartoon, where that still image of Spider-Man swinging towards a screen, and that was... You see that a lot in the Romita comics, right? That
mm-hmm.
that image of him swing. So for me, my first memory, visual library of Spider-Man is like Romita-esque. So and you always have, from I think of old Spider-Man, the first 100 issues, it's always that face it, Tiger, you hit the jackpot moment.
Yeah.
And it's that Romita romantic comic
yes.
art, right?
Yes, and no other panel strikes you quite as hard, for, at least for me, in the entire
yeah.
Spider-Man run. It just... really
it sticks out, yeah. All right.
And the Green Goblin stuff. Which,
oh yeah.
Again,
well,
we'll discuss down the line, I guess.
Yeah. Your turn, Sam.
You go ahead.
You want me to go?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I wanna
okay.
hear.
So this is one that I recently read. I had it on my shelf for a while, and sometimes you see a collected edition on so many shelves that are they're selling it at a discounted price. You kind of dismiss it. So this one was The Return of the Burglar, issue 193 to 200. Within that that storyline, it's the first appearance of Black Cat, which I had never read before. And what I like about it is in that those issues, you see all the aspects of what makes Spider-Man work. You got the issues he has with J. Jonah Jameson, who he's worried that he's figured out his identity, because in a previous issue, they were trapped together and he doesn't remember waking up, so he's convinced that Jonah's pulled off the mask and knows it's him, and he's kind of playing around with Peter Parker's career at that moment in time. And then there's Aunt May, his relationship with Aunt May, and the people wanting to go back to the house to figure out some buried treasure that's there. And then there's this offshoot story with Black Cat, and then the Kingpin, and then Mysterio. It's just all these little elements in a small amount of time that really encapsulate the Spider-Man story, and then it ends with him confronting the person who inspired everything, right? So
yeah.
for the first time reading, I'm like, in this just short amount of time, if somebody really wanted to get a sense of what made Spider-Man great, Marv Wolfman and Keith Pollard, I didn't, you know, it's kind of an artist you don't always associate with Amazing
mm-hmm.
Spider-Man, but they did a good job. So that was a fun little collection, and a lot of important things happened. Now, my question to you guys, did they retcon the burglar dying the way he did in issue 200 of a heart attack out of fear of Spider-Man? Is that something that they changed, or has that stuck?
There's so many different retellings and tellings. This is the problem. Like.
I think they did retcon that. He appeared to die, but turned out he survived, and then I think he shows up later. I want to say in like around the Eric Larson era.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, somewhere in the 300s.
Okay.
But I'm not 100%. I do remember he dies in that from fear, but I think Peter runs off so quickly that he was still alive or something.
A lot of stuff is sort of brushed over, like, in those early days. And then other stories go back and fill it in. Like, I guess this one was Marv Wolfman being of the fan generation, you know, the fanzine generation of writers, as was Jerry Conway.
Yes.
Often they would come in and almost create their own fanfic. Those early days. And again, there's the good and the bad for that, and you get some fascinating stuff, like the constant. I'm digressing.
That's good.
When you're writing comics, it's always best to do a return back to the beginning in some way. Go back to the character's roots and remind them of where they came from.
Yeah,
but seeing it from another angle too, and that's some of my, as we go down my list.
Yeah.
That's a very common theme where they revisit things and see it from a different, like, you know, because it's such an iconic origin, through how many movies and TV shows and cartoons now we've seen this origin over and over and over again.
Resonates so strongly because he feels he's to blame.
Yeah,
right?
But it's always great when you can sort of just twist it this way and see it from, for example, Mary Jane's point of view, or Aunt May's point of view, or Ben's point of view. Those are some of my favorite stories where they sort of backtrack and here's the past of it's. It's surprising. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself.
No,
but,
that's okay.
With Mary Jane, for example, those retcons actually created a much more deeper and interesting character, and you can see why.
You mean like Spider-Man 259 when they
The Tom DeFalco and also Jerry Conway's Parallel Lives, and Untold Busick's I can't remember number 16
of Untold,
Untold
Tales,
Tales, where Mary Jane again. They've sort of given you another
angle to look at.
What it was like for Mary Jane to have Peter next door. She knew that her aunt wanted to introduce her, and she didn't want to do it. So why do I want to meet this guy?
And that's a great bit from the early days, too, right? That was a whole bit. It was an ongoing joke that they stretched for years, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The
Mary Jane would be there, and
Aunt Anna was constantly trying to set Peter up with her niece.
Great stuff. Yeah, in those issues, Spider-Man loses every time. Every villain he faces has his, like,
he thinks
Black Cat has died, so he's upset at the fact that he allowed someone to lose their life again. And then Kingpin kicks the crap out of him, and leaves him. He doesn't even want to finish the fight. And then Mysterio does the same. So each of those times, he's just on the ropes.
And think of how much stuff I just went back and reread bits and pieces. You know, got stuck in a few holes of rereading. And it's amazing the amount of material they packed in there.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes to the detriment, given the number of storylines that just sort of faded out or switched writers mid-shift. But here's a case where they had all the elements and it was dovetailing towards an anniversary issue too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like the issue 200 is the one anniversary issue that is always kind of... It doesn't hold the same weight as some of the other ones do. So I wanted to read if it just didn't hold up or... And I actually ended up liking it a lot. So I wanted to bring it back to the attention of everybody. All right, Sam, you ready to go?
Yeah, okay. So number five for me was... if I'm remembering correctly, was the 80s. Spider-Man versus Wolverine, a one-shot written by Jim Owsley,
right?
Also, who would later become known as the writer Christopher Priest, who had an iconic run on Black Panther, arguably the defining run that
informs the movie that,
totally,
that just came out.
Totally.
And his partner in crime was a frequent collaborator as well, Mark Bright, the
right.
co-creator of their Quantum and Woody.
Nice.
And actually, the inker was Al Williamson.
Wow.
So it made for a very, very... And again, I think the direct market was... Well, it was fairly new to me in terms of a book that you could only get... You know, in a comic book store,
yeah.
and not on the newsstands. The paper was beautiful,
mm-hmm.
and it was actually a story that probably could have been a graphic novel. I'm not sure why. And eventually it was a square-bound prestige format when they reprinted it. But, yeah, it was a very iconic story in terms of one of the very first times that Spider-Man and Wolverine actually went head-to-head with each other. It also... took them away from his normal setting as well. It took place in Germany and even early in Jim Owsley's career, he's showing his flair for humor. As Peter, my favorite little humorous bit in there is Peter needs an outfit, so he goes and gets one from a German costume shop, except the German name for Spider-Man is written on the back of the costume, Die Spin,
I believe.
But it also had one of the most, well, just to sort of sum up as best I can, it's a Cold War intrigue about a former colleague and lover of Wolverine's back during his spy days. And again, this is back when Wolverine's past still wasn't fully as evident or revealed as it was. It was still clouded mystery. They were always hinting at things. So we didn't get a very well-defined view of him and this woman, other than the fact that she was in trouble and then lured Wolverine, and along with Spider-Man and Betty Brant's husband, Ned Leeds, who was a supporting character and a reporter, to Germany on a story, and again, Cold War stuff, Spider-Man having to jump over the Berlin Wall. Wolverine, of course, stealthily crosses the Berlin Wall. Wolverine has to noisily avoid the gunfire. Not giving away the plot too much. Actually, we're doing spoilers?
Spoilers, go right ahead.
We're doing spoilers. Well, there is... And this is controversial. I can only imagine how controversial it is without the internet. I'm sure Kev might remember discussions, but it is the first time, if I'm recalling correctly, that Spider-Man directly kills someone. Not like duck out of the way and has a glider pinned to him, but circumstances occur where... Not entirely his fault. Of course, he was dizzy, and there's an argument that Wolverine presents for that Charlie, the woman in question, commits suicide by walking into Spider-Man's path during a fight, and he punches her with all her strength, and she dies, and it was shocking.
Yeah.
It was really, really shocking, but it wasn't necessarily an unnecessary shock to me in that they really dealt with the repercussions of it in later issues, I think. He did have a bit of trauma from it.
I remember something else spinning out of that, but was kind of unrelated.
The Hobgoblin.
The whole mistake of them killing Ned Leeds in this.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And he was the original Hobgoblin, so they had to retcon that in.
Yeah.
It was funny. There's been one time in my life where I stopped collecting Spider-Man, and that was right around that time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so okay. I stopped at 263 was so awful in my mind.
Which was 263?
The photo cover where where he's holding the mask.
yeah.
It was
just
an awful story. Another fill-in.
It was a fill-in. Yeah, they had a lot of... I did
and then,
skip that one.
And then I think they followed that up with a Marvel team-up with Captain America and Spider-Man in a photo cover.
With Joe Jesko dressed as Captain America.
And I thought...
The artist Joe Jesko, yeah.
So you know what? This is just not doing it for me for Spider-Man, so I stopped.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't come back until the wedding.
Really?
Till the early 290s, and then I went back down to Dragon Lady and I filled in the missing issues. including 289 and the whole gang war storyline.
The gang war stuff is great. Yeah. And also Peter David's run on Spectacular Spider-Man as well. I always liked the love triangle of that era, because Mary Jane came back. And again, we were talking about this before, and for me, this is most interesting. This is when Mary Jane came back, revealed that she had known for years that he's Spider-Man, and that she wasn't quite... The party girl was a facade, and that added so much depth to her. And then the whole love triangle between the Black Cat as well, the bad girl.
And she didn't care about him.
Yeah.
She cared about Spider-Man. She just wanted to have sex with Spider-Man.
Which, again, was a twist on the whole dynamic. But
it gave him the choice. He's like, I could be Spider-Man all the time and be with the Black Cat, or I could go back to being Peter Parker and be with Mary Jane. So where do I want to go? Would I rather be Spider-Man all the time? Or does Peter Parker matter? And one of those great choices were.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, we were just mentioning briefly the gang war. I feel like, again, there were so many writers, so many books, and so many musical chairs on the books during that era. I think Christopher Priest / Jim Owsley was the Spider-Man editor of that era as well, and on his blog talks a lot about the confusion and what happened with the especially since he's the writer who killed Hobgoblin. Roger Stern had left at that point. Like, otherwise, the setup was actually fantastic.
He said he had always known, right?
They eventually
that he
revealed
it to be Roderick Kingsley.
Yeah, if eventually that was, but because the threads just sort of unravel from there, from the gang war and multiple writers.
And I don't think it picks up again until you get Michelini and McFarlane.
Yes.
And at that point, they unify the book and they bring some kind of consistency to it.
Yeah.
Before that, the only thing really keeping together was that. They had that one inker who would ink, Jim Mooney, who would ink everything and try to tie it together with that same look.
I felt like Peter David was kind of holding things together over in Spectacular.
Was it
Spider-Man
Spectacular or Web? It was Web, I think.
I thought he was doing because Death of Gene Wolfe was
it was
Spectacular. And then
Spectacular.
He did.
Okay,
I think he did like 25 issues. He was with Rich Buckler, who's not my favorite. He's got he can be good sometimes, and he had some good issues in there.
Yeah.
But his storytelling
was good in that.
Yeah.
Peter David's a great Spider-Man.
I felt like Peter David and the fairly consistent art of Rich Buckler?
Buckler,
at the time was kind of holding things together for me, at least as a reader. Although it wasn't even Peter David's doing a lot of crazy experimental stuff,
right?
Which I actually quite enjoyed and are going to be in. I'm digressing a lot.
I think that corresponded with that whole era that I stopped.
Yeah.
The time Peter David was on Spectacular,
and then whoever was on Web as well,
yeah.
And then they had Secret Wars tie-ins, and
that got messy with the Secret Wars.
Yeah, having three books with
Secret Wars 2, which actually is a good story if I remember. Isn't that the one with the Fire Lord stories in there?
Okay, there's also the building that falls down. That
it's all in
he
gold,
turns
right?
Into gold. Yeah,
with the burn covers, right?
Yeah.
That was a good collection. Ghosts of the Past and the Epic Collection. They collect all like the Friends and DeFalco run, and that's some really good stuff. That also has like Cometh the Commuter.
Mm-hmm.
That was a Peter David.
The Friends and DeFalco run are solid. Again, for me, they're not hugely high on the list. They were exciting action adventure stories. He did do that interesting thing with Mary Jane, for which I will give him.
Yep.
Full credit, but to me it was sort of a business as usual, a good solid action, which has always been.
I think they decided that that's where they were going with the wedding, and so they had to bring Mary Jane back and give her some depth.
Well, they apparently they were gonna do a more slow burn apparently, and then stand aside, and then they had to rush it, like they were.
Yeah.
They were doing the slow burn in that they were friends but not together. At that point, and then all of a sudden, like and breakneck thing, suddenly they're back together.
Shea Stadium was available for a wedding, right? So they have to remember they married
them. That was the story, wasn't it?
Stanley married them at Shea Stadium in real life.
That's right.
To coincide with it. It was a big spectacle.
That's right, and he made the decision in the newspaper strip, and then the comics had to rush that into production, I guess.
I have that issue of Spider-Man Wolverine. I've never read it.
Really?
Because as a kid, my older cousin was a really big Spider-Man fan, and he had that book. He had bought it at a flea market, but he had it at the time on a shelf, almost like a can't touch it. He held it up there, and he said, "That's the most expensive comic book right now on the market," is what he told me.
So you coveted it.
So yeah, so I see it now. I'm like, I don't want to ruin the copy that I have. I need to get like a collected edition or a beat up copy that I can read. Mm-hmm. So I want to read it because I know how, one, it's a good story, and it's also controversial.
Yeah.
And
it was also, as you were saying, to him, it was really special.
It was really special,
like,
yeah.
Because it's not like today where there's a crossover every 2 seconds. Like, you know, these crossovers were more of an event when they happened, especially they put it in this special book that I couldn't get at the spinner rack at the variety store.
Exactly.
I had to go and pay extra money, too. It was like a double-sized comic on nice paper, so it was probably like a $3 or $4 book as opposed to 75 cents, or 95 cents, however much comics.
Gotta find
did
that.
Did you find the ending controversial at the time when you?
You know what? I didn't read it when it came out,
and
it was one of those things that I got as a back issue. Never got around to reading until much later, and it's good, but it's very jarring compared to the artwork of. Like at the time, because I think you were coming out of the Ron Friends era.
Yeah.
And then by the time I had it, we were well into McFarlane. And McFarlane's art was so intriguing and interesting compared to this. And see, Mark Bright is very standard workman like. Mm-hmm. It's like a Dave Ross.
But with an Al Williamson sheen on it. For me, that was
not as Al Williamson as you would get Romita Jr. on Peter Parker Spider-Man.
That's fair. Later.
Where it's like very thick black lines and sketchy and everything. But that was something I came back to later, and it's a good story, but it doesn't hold the resonance. Also, the fact that the whole Ned Leeds dies in it, and they made a mistake. It's like, well, they screwed up. They can't even talk to each other.
Hobgoblin.
You know, in the offices to get the story right.
So. Yeah. It is interesting, though. I think they did put Jim Owsley did get an issue or two of I want to say either Amazing or I think it was Amazing, where he filled in and then tried to follow up between the PTSD that Peter was suffering over accidentally killing someone, and then the Hobgoblin thing.
Well, there was one storyline I never did read, which was post Craven's Last Hunt. Where Peter Parker was in an asylum.
Oh, yeah. What's Wrong with Mummy?
Yeah.
It was, and again, that was another special event, too.
Yeah.
Like, it followed right on the heels of Craven's Last Hunt, and very standalone.
Yeah, and I didn't like it.
And the Senti, right?
Yeah.
I just saw that trade at the store.
I found it intriguing, but again, it wasn't as impactful, if I can use a made-up word, as I would have liked, given the subject matter.
Yeah.
All right. Shall we continue to the next round?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Number four.
Well, before we continue, I got a couple of that questions for you guys.
Yeah.
So we already did Ditko Romita.
Okay.
You decided. So, Gil Kane or Ross Andrew?
Gil Kane?
Yeah.
See, I'd probably go Ross Andrew.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
I think Gil Kane's a real acquired taste in terms of.
I find Kane was so heavily inked by Romita during that time too. That
that's
it's
true.
Of,
it's indissoluble.
There's a lot of Romita in there,
which is probably why I lean towards it.
Mm. I never really liked Kane's artwork until I was older and I could respect it.
Right.
That's just like Gene Colan. I didn't like Gene Colan at the time. I found it too arty, or something about it was not right.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at like Spider-Man 99, it's very Gil Kane.
Mm-hmm.
And even 100, 101, 102, lots of those Gil Kane faces and close-ups and stuff like that.
Well, the interesting foreshortening and stuff he always had with his figures as well. What's the appeal of Ross Andrew to you?
To me, that's the Spider-Man I was reading when I was coming to Spider-Man.
Ah, of course.
So around 125 in that era.
Mm-hmm.
The arrival of the Punisher, the Clone Saga.
That's right.
Yeah, that's good
aside
stuff.
From Ross Andrew, something about him and teeth didn't work. His characters all looked like they had problems with their teeth. But other than that, that was a perfect Spider-Man. You know, Mary Jane was pretty, Gwen, you know, had just died, so we were dealing with all of that.
Anyway. Good era, yeah. Ross Andrews, good. Okay, how about the people who followed Stan Lee? Jerry Conway, Len Wein, Marv Wolfman.
Jerry Conway.
Jerry Conway.
Yeah, I go with Jerry Conway on that too, yeah.
I think that's
for
pretty,
obvious reasons.
Yeah, it's the runaway.
We talk about the death of Gwen Stacy.
He did a lot in his time. I mean, to follow up Stan.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
At 20 years old.
And he had the formula too. Like, yeah. I guess he was Peter Parker's age, entering college, I think. This was the whole, you know, someone close enough to college age to be able to write about being in college.
Yeah.
And the soap opera as well really resonated, especially we were talking about the Gwen Stacy, Mary Jane stuff, really.
Yeah.
You know, there's a certain transformation she undergoes as well. Like, there's a power to having what is it now, 50 years, close to 40 or 50 year old character that is allowed to evolve in such a fashion over time.
Okay, one last one before we get into the next round. Romita Jr. or Ron Frenz?
Ron Frenz.
Ron Frenz?
Ron Frenz.
See, I would go with Romita Jr.
Yeah, I go Romita Jr.
Yeah.
But I love Ron Frenz too.
I again, more old school. Just something about this almost the scratchiness of Romita at the time didn't necessarily.
True, but I think of like, so you had Romita Jr.
stuff,
and then you had Frenz. So you had that first run with the Will o' the Wisp story, the Juggernaut story. Romita Jr. is really coming into his own,
mm-hmm.
and then he comes back later, and then he's kind of that dark, scratchy. Over eight.
That's true. That's
stuff.
True.
But
back when he was
stuff,
a little more like his dad.
He was very like his dad.
Yeah, literally drawing on his dad's lap, I imagine.
Pretty much. Yeah.
It's funny because the Ron Frenz he said that he was really just trying to do the best Ditko he could do.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were a Ditko guy and you were a Romita guy, and Romita Jr. was saying, I was just trying to do the best version of my dad.
Yeah, yeah.
So you guys like flipped it now.
Yeah, that's well, for true. Me, he really came, Romita Jr. came into his own, let's say, around, I want to call it Daredevil Year One, but what's it actually called?
Man Without Fear. Yeah.
Where there's his style, you know what I mean? He'd been working on it. He'd been slowly getting scratchier in X-Men, and then finally, this is me. This is who I am.
Yeah.
This is my style from here until I depart to DC. And oddly enough, as you know, wonderful as that style was for Daredevil, Man Without Fear, I didn't feel like that style really fit Spider-Man.
Mm.
Is sort of my opinion.
Okay.
All right, round two. Should we continue?
Sure, okay. Well, my number four choice is, drawn by John Romita Jr., is Amazing Spider-Man 229 and 230. Nothing can stop the Juggernaut.
Great pick.
Very great.
To me, summarizes everything about Spider-Man's unwillingness to ever give up, even in the face of sanity and mortal danger and everything else. Spider-Man perseveres and finds a way to beat the enemy. And, you know, and here we have the ultimate villain, Juggernaut, who is untouchable, undefeatable. And what is Spider-Man compared to the Juggernaut? Juggernaut's just powerhouse. He takes on the Hulk. And so you end up with lots of scenes of Spider-Man crawling over his armor, trying to pull the helmet off, trying to do all these things. And he's unsuccessful. And everyone, I mean, Juggernaut kills Madame Web. Destroys half the city, and Spider-Man's paralyzed.
That was shocking to me as well.
Yeah.
I remember that.
And then that final battle in the building where he's tricked him onto a site where he's in quicksand.
The cement.
Yeah.
And then he can't get out, and eventually he drowns in the cement. Of course, you know, Juggernaut can't die, the nature of his mystical power. And Spider-Man knew that as well, but it was enough to defeat him. And get him into a place where someone could take care of him. You know, that wasn't him, I guess, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
But just a great two-part story.
And
well-drawn, very interesting.
Great covers, too.
Fantastic pick.
Yeah,
sure.
Great pick. I was thinking about putting that one on my list as well.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Okay.
My turn now.
Yep.
So in the same vein of something like that, where Spider-Man has to fight to the point of no quitting, I enjoyed Coming Home from Straczynski and John Romita Jr. issues 30 to 35, with first appearance of Moreland and Ezekiel, And it was, I remember buying that trade for really cheap, having not read any Amazing Spider-Man for a while. I was really into Ultimate Spider-Man. So I picked this up, knew it was a little bit older at the time. And it was just so shrouded in mystery of all these characters. Like, who's Ezekiel? Is he Peter in the future? Yeah. And who's this Moreland guy? Is he a vampire? Why is it such a threat? And to see Peter fight where he has this fear of this character who seems to have no weakness.
Unstoppable.
He's unstoppable. But he's fighting, and his every time you see him, a little bit of his costume is getting ripped away. His hair is coming out of the top, or, you know, it's all in tatters, to the point where he figures out a way to stop him, and he's laying in his bed all bandaged up, and it ends with Aunt May seeing him in the Spider-Man costume, battered and bruised, and just seeing it's kind of reminded me of that can't stop the nothing can stop the Juggernaut, where this guy is obsessed with having to do what he's got to do to the point of possible death. So and then what follows that is the conversation that he has in issue 38, right?
Yes.
with Aunt May, that I absolutely love. So everything that era specifically, there's a lot of history of things that happened in Spider-Man that today are still, you know, Dan Slott just had the Spider-Verse with Moreland there.
Yeah.
And I think in between there they even had the Black issue for the Twin Towers.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
As like an interlude.
Yes.
So that was just really interesting era. And I personally love John Romita Jr.'s art during that time. Mm-hmm. That's kind of like my favorite version of Spider-Man.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned you were coming from Ultimate Spider-Man to this.
Yeah.
Because at the time, Spider-Man books were not selling as well as they had been.
No.
And Ultimate Spider-Man was a hit, bona fide hit.
Yeah.
People were reading like crazy. And in a lot of ways, coming home and that story arc saved the regular Spider-Man line.
Yeah.
Because it showed that there was still interest in the old Spider-Man, in a sense.
Yeah.
As opposed to the new Ultimate one.
Yeah.
And all the things you could do with an older Spider-Man as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And I think at the time, I was a huge Babylon 5 fan, so for me, putting Straczynski on the book was phenomenal.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of controversy as well, because Marvel at the time was putting a lot of, I guess, TV and movie writers as sort of stunts to different effect. But I think, at least in these initial issues, Straczynski was doing some really daring stuff, especially...
Yeah.
For me, it's all about the relationships, and the Aunt May stuff was phenomenal.
Yeah,
although
really
we
good.
Talked in the last podcast about how when she died during the all the confusing clone site, was that 300 she died?
400.
400.
That was
great. Yeah. So again, there's you know, and then there's different times when she's known and not known, but that did kick off a really great era of stories in terms of moving the relationship between Peter and May forward, like some of the issues that I'll be mentioning later touch on that because it gave them a great launching off point to redefine their relationship.
Yeah, it's nice to think that the person that he's been fighting his whole life for without anybody knowing, every time he's in the suit, he's always thinking of his taking care of her.
Yeah.
Now knowing that she knows what he's doing, that ability to be able to talk to her about it, it's so freeing.
Now, my memory, again, we talk about my fuzzy memory. Did Straczynski do it first, or did Bendis on Ultimate Spider-Man?
I think Straczynski.
Straczynski, I think, did first.
Gotcha. And then Bendis did it differently.
Yeah, the Aunt May knowing in Ultimate Spider-Man.
The younger, more in-your-face Aunt May.
Yeah.
And again, it's interesting how they handled it completely differently and redefined their relationships in different ways because they're in different points of their life with a different interpretation of Aunt May as a younger contemporary woman versus the...
And I like the Straczynski story that you get the parallel of... You know, obviously Peter blames himself for the death of Uncle
that's
Ben.
That's right.
But Aunt May also blames herself for the death of
Uncle
Ben.
Yes,
because they had a fight or something.
Yeah,
and
he
was sulking and he left the house sulking.
And then the two of them learned that they were holding the same. And you can see the similarities between the characters and how she's really like his mother in the sense of it. So they both interpreted the situation the same way from their point of view and blamed themselves for his death.
Yeah.
Which was fascinating. Just... really smart.
He really did some great character stuff in those early issues.
Yeah, and I Aunt May is one of those characters where I read her in the older stuff because she's a trope. I'm like, just kill her already. It sounds heartless, but it's just like...
But it became such a trope. They were even they were constantly making fun of the fact that she was sick or would have a heart attack or whatever.
So to put her in that space where now she's useful in the sense of she can hear him out. She can root for him. She can defend him.
Yeah. Also the anger, too. It's like, why did you lie to me? We're two... Yeah. Two of us should be, as close as two people could be.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's all out of love. And but her initial...
And it was interesting how, they killed her in Spider-Man 400. Then Byrne revived her as part... Because he believed that Spider-Man was essentially lacking without an Aunt May. Mm-hmm. That she was required. I don't know if I agree with that completely. Yeah. It seemed very strange that they had to retcon the 400 story, which is very well done.
Yeah,
great issue. Say,
especially during a difficult time in Spider-Man's history.
Yeah.
In terms of what was going on with the title.
To say that
she
was an actress and he didn't catch that.
Yeah, it was bad.
Which is too bad. But this is what happens, right? We reset, and again, it's a shame. What ultimately happened with not Brand New Day, the
One More Day.
In terms of Aunt May coming back without the memory is how they reset it with all the Mephisto stuff and all. But it's one thing that I felt maybe shouldn't have been reset necessarily.
Yeah, I agree.
Because and it's something that the Brand New Day crew and then Slott. But again, we hadn't seen that relationship in a while, so. Resetting it worked for the time, but then it eventually creeped back into what you were describing, which was the formula of him just always sneaking off behind her back and lying to her and all that, rather than moving the relationship forward.
And did you guys like Romita Jr. or with Scott Hanna or with Klaus Janson? I prefer Scott Hanna.
Klaus Janson.
Yeah.
Because, again,
I'm going to go Scott Hanna.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And I always... associate Klaus Janson with Romita Jr. Mm-hmm. But at the last Fan Expo I saw Scott Hanna and he had all of those Romita Jr. I guess prints or things that he had inked, and I finally seen the difference. I'm like, yeah, this is the one that I really enjoy. So I didn't realize it until this last summer.
For me, again, it's that nervous energy of Klaus Janson.
No, I like Klaus Janson,
especially
too.
On the Miller with the Miller stuff and then spilling over onto Romita's a later style, as we've been describing it.
Yeah. Sam, your pick?
Number four is Spider-Man Blue.
Ooh.
And again, I had a little bit of trouble because you kind of, in some ways, want to avoid the storylines that are kind of the greatest hits.
Yeah.
You know, going back. But I think in this case, it just had a lot of emotional punch to it. And it's about grief. And healing, and moving on with your life as well. Just to give the quick summary, it's Peter. It's sort of a present day with him, married to Mary Jane, but also acknowledging he was once in love with Gwen. And it's a nostalgic love letter to that period we've been talking about, as well as just showing like. Gwen was the love of his younger life, and here's his present day wife, who was Gwen's friend as well, and accepts it. And what's the line? Say hi to Gwen for me. Was Mary Jane's that like just because again, taking into context that Mary Jane and Peter's relationship moved forward because she was there for him after Gwen's death, right? And this is sort of the fascinating thing as well. This was done before the death of Jeff Loeb's own son, right? Because it's sort of...
I think so, yeah.
Jeff Loeb did eventually write a lot of stuff that helped him process the death of his son in terms of... was it the post-Civil War? Death of Captain America?
Yeah.
Again, for me, it's getting all the feels. And then... going back there, looking at it from a different angle, and the art.
Tim Sale.
There's something magical about Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale together.
Yeah, but they're great together.
Tim Sale on the Marvel characters, to me, they've done a lot of DC stuff as well, but there's just something, the way he interprets, especially Mary Jane and Gwen too. Like Tim Sale's stylized women are just phenomenal. I'm fairly sure this is at the top of a lot
it was on
of
my list
folks in it terms of what number was it for you
on, I on didn't really list? Put mine in the list of my favorite okay. one but it was gonna
but
be my last one
five?
It was gonna be the last one I mentioned
well here's your turn to talk about why it resonates
I guess it's one of those books for me that if someone had never read Spider-Man before and I was going to think of something to suggest to them to see if they like the character, that would be the book. Because I don't feel Spider-Man is... This is why I like talking about a top five Spider-Man story. It's hard for me because he's not like a Batman where there's a Dark Knight Returns, there's a Year One, there's a Hush, something, or a Long Halloween. With Spider-Man, it's all... You got to kind of know the family.
Yes,
you
got to
know
the
supporting cast, and it's hard to say. Yeah, Reed can't stop the Juggernaut. Nothing can stop the Juggernaut, and you'll see why he's great. You might, but this one goes back. It harkens back to the original Ditko and Lee, and then the Lee and Romita stuff. It has all of that, those elements, and you really see the heart of Peter and his loss and his loves and his motivations. And the, like you said, the art, there's a splash page. I remember him fighting Electro and it just like covers both pages when you open. And it's just, it feels like you're in the 60s, but it's kind of timeless. So if I had to suggest one book to somebody to read Spider-Man, I would say try Spider-Man Blue. See if
and
you
I
like
think
it.
Timeless really is a good term for what Sale was doing.
Yeah,
like there,
exactly.
There is like you, it doesn't date.
No.
To me, there is a contemporary yet retro timeless to the way he's
it seems very 60s and yet modern at the same time.
You could put that up against any of the modern stylists who have their own sort of and sort of the clean line style as well. I think he might have been it's you can sort of lump him in early on with Mignola, you know, doing that kind of, you know, stylistic thing, but also moving forward, there's you can also put him in with Darwin Cook, for example, or
that's
Jay
true,
Bone,
true.
Or any of those guys in terms of, I guess they might even refer to themselves, I'm doing finger quotes, cartoonists.
Right.
That's Darwin Cook's term, right? He likes to refer to himself as a cartoonist.
There's a nostalgic aspect to it.
Mm-hmm. And a stylistic thing. You can really tell that this is their sort of exaggerated way of storytelling.
And I found too in Spider-Man Blue, it informs you a lot of the supporting cast, because there's that one scene where they're all at Harry's apartment, and I think Flash tells everybody, you know, Spider-Man's inspired me to join the army, like I can't be a superhero, but because of him. And so you kind of see, oh, that's the old bully who loves Peter's alter ego, that it inspires him. And it's enough that if you jump into another book in present time, you'll be like, I know what that relationship means.
And again, this is what I mean in terms of greatest hit storytelling, in which you take something from the past and then you're sort of retelling it. And generally, you know, this
adding
one was
a layer.
But we're also saying, you know, it's the continuity of all the Spider-Man stuff. So the fact that, what do we call it? Three-dimensional, in terms of comics terms, flat comic. This is three-dimensional storytelling in that you've also got the resonance of Flash, reading this in context of Flash being Peter's bully. You know, the extra subtext of him later on losing his legs as a soldier and becoming Agent Venom.
Exactly.
You know, even though that wasn't even conceived at the time, but you can layer that on to this one text because you've got so many other texts that resonate with it.
Yeah. Good pick, Sam. I like it. So that's our round two?
That's round two.
All right, let me go through the this or that list.
Okay.
So now we're in the 300s era. McFarlane, Larson, or Bagley?
McFarlane.
Larson.
I'm going to go Bagley.
Which surprises me because I love Ultimate Spider-Man, and had it been that era, it would have been no question Bagley, but McFarlane was just such an innovator. Mm. And it was a return to, I guess, what we call pop comics.
Okay.
In terms of just visually exciting, when Marvel billed itself as pop art, to me, McFarlane was pop art at the time. And you know, you flip through this, and there's a lot of pop and punch to his art.
Right. Okay. Larson, for you?
So, I mean, I agree about Todd, but I didn't think Todd went as cartoony as he could go with that book. He did definitely with the proportions and the way he drew Spider-Man, mm-hmm. the webbing. He added a lot to the storytelling. And Larson picks up that baton, and I think he takes it to a whole other level. I love the way his Spider-Man looks with the costume that's basically red and black. Gone are the blue highlights. They've taken that out for the most part. And the whole return of the Sinister Six storyline.
Yeah,
which was completely over the top, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, it was crazy.
But it restored interest in those classic Spider-Man villains that didn't really show up. A few of them were in the McFarlane run, but not a lot. Sandman, you got Mephisto.
And I think that reflects Larson's love, being a Silver Age guy. Yeah, especially of that era. Like, and obviously what fascinates me as well is he hated Venom, so he just took Venom as far as he could and exaggerated, and the fans loved it,
right? Yeah.
Even though he was just trying to do a piss take.
He was actually discussing it the other day on his Facebook
page. Oh, was he? Okay.
You know, he says, I've always attributed that crazy tongue and the saliva and all that stuff to Todd, but when I look at Todd's covers of what he did, mm-hmm. he didn't do the tongue.
Yeah.
You know, he had a
the big grin.
Teeth.
The rictus grin, as we like to call it.
Yeah.
We didn't have a tongue that hung out of his mouth and he had green saliva everywhere and stuff like that. He says, so I guess I'll take ownership. That was me. And I guess I did do that.
And wasn't Larson sort of in conflict with Michelini as well, in terms of the push and pull of what Michelini was writing versus what Larson wanted to draw?
Yeah, I think there was tension. That's why they gave him Spider-Man after
McFarlane left.
Yeah.
They said, here, you can write it as well as draw.
Yeah, but there was some magic in that tension, I thought.
I agree. I think there were some great storylines. The Doctor Doom story, 350, is very good. I think Cosmic Spider-Man is in there somewhere.
Did you like Cosmic Spider-Man?
I thought it was okay.
It was
a good storyline.
Yeah.
It was fun.
It was different. He's been struggling below his power level with all the other heroes, and suddenly he's way above everybody else.
Yeah.
And, you know, knocking the Hulk into orbit and doing all that stuff. That was a fun storyline, and I thought that was an experiment.
Yeah.
Although, I don't know, at some points I also thought they might have taken it too far. Was it Spider-Man with the cybernetic stuff all over him? And the Round Robin, the Return of the Sidekick, was crazy. And
yeah,
also,
we're jumping all over. So in Return of, Revenge of the Sinister Six, in Spider-Man does get this kind of crazy cybernetic arm as part of Larson's run. Which
became a toy too.
Yes.
I think Toy Biz made a toy of that.
But then in Bagley's run, it was the Brown Robin.
Oh, was it Bagley's run? Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, sidekicks.
Bagley followed
Larson.
That's right. That's right. After he won the
trial book.
Yeah, he won the trial book, but then I guess he had a really good run on New Warriors.
Yes.
Yeah.
If I'm remembering.
Which was a great book.
Fantastic. Underrated.
Yeah.
Hugely underrated.
But it was interesting, you went from McFarlane to Larson to Bagley. Bagley is a much safer choice.
Yeah, and more classic-looking Spider-Man as well.
Yeah.
Even though I think because of the coming off of Larson and McFarlane, you did see him try to do some of the flourishes, which he would later remove in Ultimate Spider-Man, which I thought was perfect for the clean storytelling they were trying to tell in Ultimate Spider-Man. I felt like he was, again, he even lasted through into the clone run, the clone storylines, didn't he?
He was, he was.
And created Carnage? Did he co-create?
Yeah, he was, I think he was during that run,
361 was part of his,
Yeah.
Because Bagley went into the 400s.
Bagley did 400.
Yeah, he had a...
Sure. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, he had a pretty legendary run, which is why he was reluctant to. He was only going to do Ultimate Spider-Man for 8 issues, right?
I don't know.
I think the story goes, like, he was reluctant because he's like, I don't want to be typecast, but then they convinced him to do the first arc, and then
there was such a strong response to it too.
Yeah. A little bit. And then I'm guessing the extra income from his covers appearing on every single product you can imagine.
Yeah.
As well. I think Quesada did the first one or two covers.
Yeah.
And then Bagley did the rest. And then any manner of product in the early 2000s had a Bagley image on it, right?
Yeah.
He has a good visual Spider-Man library.
Yeah. And I can see for a generation of kids coming after McFarlane, Bagley is their iconic Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Like, I can. And for good reason, too.
Yeah.
Solid storyteller.
Yeah, very good. Okay, boys, round three.
All right, round
three.
Kev,
take it away.
So I'm kind of repeating myself, but my number three choice is...
What a cliffhanger. That's all for now, folks. If you want to know what's up next, the top three stories that the boys picked, download the episode already. Hit it.